broken only by his mother's moaning. Chapter 57. The Emigrants. One thing more I had to do before yielding myself to the shock of these emotions. It was to conceal what had occurred from those who were going away, and to dismiss them on their voyage in happy ignorance. In this, no time was to be lost. I took Mr. Micawber aside that same night, and confided to him the task of standing between Mr. Peggotty and intelligence of the late catastrophe. He zealously undertook to do so, and to intercept any newspaper through which it might, without such precautions, reach him. "If it penetrates to him, sir," said Mr. Micawber, striking himself on the breast, "it shall first pass through this body." Mr. Micawber, I must observe, in his adaptation of himself to a new state of society, had acquired a bold, buccaneering air, not absolutely lawless, but defensive and prompt. One might have supposed him a child of the wilderness, long accustomed to live out of the confines of civilization, and about to return to his native wilds. He had provided himself, among other things, with a complete suit of oilskin, and a straw hat with a very low crown, pitched or corked on the outside. In this rough clothing, with a common mariner's telescope under his arm, and a shrewd trick of casting up his eye at the sky as looking out for dirty weather, he was far more nautical after his manner than Mr. Peggotty. His whole family, if I may so express it, were cleared for action. I found Mrs. Micawber in the closest and most uncompromising of bonnets made fast under the chin, and in a shawl which tied her up, as I'd been tied up when my aunt first received me, like a bundle, and was secured behind at the waist in a strong knot. Miss Micawber, I found made snug for stormy weather in the same manner, with nothing superfluous about her. Master Micawber was hardly visible in a Guernsey shirt and the shaggiest suit of slops I ever saw, and the children were done up like preserved meats in impervious cases. Both Mr. Micawber and his eldest son wore their sleeves loosely turned back at the wrists, as being ready to lend a hand in any direction, and to tumble up, or sing out, "Yo, heave, yo," on the shortest notice. Thus Traddles and I found them, at nightfall, assembled on the wooden steps, at that time known as Hungerford Stairs, watching the departure of a boat with some of their property on board. I told Traddles of the terrible event, and it had greatly shocked him, but there could be no doubt of the kindness of keeping it a secret, and he'd come to help me in this last service. It was here that I took Mr. Micawber aside and received his promise. The Micawber family were lodged in a little dirty tumble-down public house, which in those days was close to the stairs, and whose protruding wooden rooms overhung the river. The family, as emigrants, being objects of some interest in and about Hungerford, attracted so many beholders that we were glad to take refuge in their room. It was one of the wooden chambers upstairs, with the tide flowing underneath. My aunt and Agnes were there, busily making some little extra comforts in the way of dress for the children. Peggotty was quietly assisting with the old insensible workbox, yard measure, and a bit of wax candle before her, that had now outlived so much. It was not easy to answer her inquiries, still less to whisper Mr. Peggotty, when Mr. Micawber brought him in, that I had given the letter and all was well. But I did both, and made them happy. If I showed any trace of what I felt, my own sorrows were sufficient to account for it. "And when does the ship sail, Mr. Micawber?" asked my aunt. Mr. Micawber considered it necessary to prepare either my aunt or his wife by degrees, and said, "Sooner than he had expected yesterday." "The boat brought you word, I suppose," said my aunt.
"It did, ma'am,"
he returned. "Well," said my aunt, "and she sails?"
"Madam," he replied, "I'm informed that we must positively be on board before 7 tomorrow morning."
"Heyday," said my aunt, "that's soon. Is it a sea-going fact, Mr. Peggotty?"
"'Tis so, ma'am. She'll drop down the river for that there tide. If Master Davy and my sister comes aboard at Gravesend afternoon the next day, they'll see the last on us."
"And that we shall do," said I, "be sure.
Until then, and until we are at sea, observed Mr. Micawber, with a glance of intelligence at me. "Mr. Peggotty and myself will constantly keep a double lookout together on our goods and chattels. Emma, my love," said Mr. Micawber, clearing his throat in his magnificent way, "my friend, Mr. Thomas Traddles, is so obliging as to solicit in my ear that he should have the privilege of ordering the ingredients necessary to the composition of a moderate portion of that beverage which is peculiarly associated in our minds with the roast beef of old England. I allude to, in short, punch. Under ordinary circumstances, I should scruple to entreat the indulgence of Miss Trotwood and Miss Wickfield, but I can only say for myself," said my aunt, "that I will drink all happiness and success to you, Mr. Micawber, with the utmost pleasure." "And I too," said Agnes, with a smile. Mr. Micawber immediately descended to the bar, where he appeared to be quite at home, and in due time returned with a steaming jug. I could not but observe that he had been peeling the lemons with his own clasp knife, which, as became the knife of a practical settler, was about a foot long, and which he wiped not wholly without ostentation on the sleeve of his coat. Mrs. Micawber and the two elder members of the family I now found to be provided with similar formidable instruments, while every child had its own wooden spoon attached to its body by a strong line. In a similar anticipation of life afloat and in the bush, Mr. Micawber, instead of helping Mrs. Micawber and his eldest son and daughter to punch in wine glasses, which he might easily have done, for there was a shelf full in the room, served it out to them in a series of villainous little tin pots. And I never saw him enjoy anything so much as drinking out of his own particular pint pot and putting it in his pocket at the close of the evening. "The luxuries of the old country," said Mr. Micawber, with an intense satisfaction in their announcement, "we abandon. The denizens of the forest cannot, of course, expect to participate in the refinements of the land of the free." Here a boy came in to say that Mr. Micawber was wanted downstairs. "I have a presentiment," said Mrs. Micawber, setting down her tin pot, "that it is a member of my family." "If so, my dear," observed Mr. Micawber, with his usual suddenness of warmth on that subject, "as the member of your family, whoever he, she, or it may be, has kept us waiting for a considerable period, perhaps the member may now wait my convenience."
"Micawber," said his wife in a low tone, "at such a time as this..."
"It is not meet," said Mr. Micawber, rising, "that every nice offence should bear its comment. Emma, I stand reproved."
"The loss, Micawber," observed his wife, "has been my family's, not yours. If my family are at length sensible of the deprivation to which their own conduct has in the past exposed them, and now desire to extend the hand of fellowship, let it not be repulsed."
"My dear," he returned, "so be it. If not for their sakes, for mine, Micawber," said his wife. "Emma," he returned, "that view of the question is, at such a moment, irresistible. I cannot even now distinctly pledge myself to fall upon your family's neck, but the member of your family who is now in attendance shall have no genial warmth frozen by me."
Mr. Micawber withdrew, and was absent some little time, in the course of which Mrs. Micawber was not wholly free from an apprehension that words might have arisen between him and the member. At length the same boy reappeared and presented me with a note written in pencil, and headed in a legal manner, "Heap versus Micawber." From this document I learned that Mr. Micawber, being again arrested, was in a final paroxysm of despair, and that he begged me to send him his knife and pint pot by bearer, as they might prove serviceable during the brief remainder of his existence in jail. He also requested, as a last act of friendship, that I would see his family to the parish workhouse and forget that such a being ever lived. Of course I answered this note by going down with the boy to pay the money, where I found Mr. Micawber sitting in a corner looking darkly at the sheriff's officer who had effected the capture. On his release he embraced me with the utmost fervour and made an entry of the transaction in his pocket-book, being very particular, I recollect, about a halfpenny I inadvertently omitted from my statement of the total. This momentous pocket-book was a timely reminder to him of another transaction. On our return to the room upstairs, where he accounted for his absence by saying that it had been occasioned by circumstances over which he had no control, he took out of it a large sheet of paper, folded small and quite covered with long sums, carefully worked. From the glimpse I had of them, I should say that I never saw such sums out of a school ciphering book. These, it seemed, were calculations of compound interest on what he called the principal amount of 41, 10, 11 and a half for various periods. After a careful consideration of these, and an elaborate estimate of his resources, he'd come to the conclusion to select that sum which represented the amount with compound interest to 2 years, 15 calendar months and 14 days from that date. For this, he had drawn a note of hand with great neatness, which he handed over to Traddles on the spot. A discharge of his debt in full, as between man and man, with many acknowledgments. "I have still a presentiment," said Mrs. Micawber, pensively shaking her head, "that my family will appear on board before we finally depart." Mr. Micawber evidently had his presentiment on the subject too, but he put it in his tin pot and swallowed it. "If you have any opportunity of sending letters home on your passage, Mrs. Micawber," said my aunt, "you must let us hear from you, you know." "My dear Miss Trotwood," she replied, "I shall only be too happy to think that anyone expects to hear from us. I shall not fail to correspond. Mr. Copperfield, I trust, as an old and familiar friend, will not object to receive occasional intelligence himself from one who knew him when the twins were yet unconscious." I said that I should hope to hear whenever she had an opportunity of writing. "Please heaven, there will be many such opportunities," said Mr. Micawber. "The ocean in these times is a perfect fleet of ships, and we can hardly fail to encounter many in running over. It is merely crossing," said Mr. Micawber, trifling with his eyeglass. "Merely crossing. The distance is quite imaginary." I think now how odd it was, but how wonderfully like Mr. Micawber, that when he went from London to Canterbury he should have talked as if he were going to the farthest limits of the earth, and when he went from England to Australia, as if he were going for a little trip across the Channel. "On the voyage I shall endeavour," said Mr. Micawber, "occasionally to spin them a yarn. And the melody of my son Wilkins will, I trust, be acceptable at the galley fire. When Mrs. Micawber has her sea legs on," an expression in which I hope there is no conventional impropriety, "she will give them, I dare say, little tafflin. Porpoises and dolphins, I believe, will be frequently observed athwart our bows, and either on the starboard or the larboard quarter, objects of interest will be continually descried. In short," said Mr. Micawber, with the old genteel air, "the probability is, all will be found so exciting, low and aloft, that when the lookout, stationed in the main top, cries, 'Land ho!' we shall be very considerably astonished." With that, he flourished off the contents of his little tin pot, as if he'd made the voyage and had passed the first-class examination before the highest naval authorities. "What I chiefly hope, my dear Mr. Copperfield," said Mrs. Micawber, "is that in some branches of our family we may live again in the old country." "Don't frown, Micawber. I don't now refer to my own family, but to our children's children." "However vigorous the sapling," said Mrs. Micawber, shaking her head, "I cannot forget the parent tree, and when our race attains to eminence and fortune I own, I should wish that fortune to flow into the coffers of Britannia." "My dear," said Mr. Micawber, "Britannia must take her chance. I am bound to say that she's never done much for me, and that I have no particular wish upon the subject." "Micawber," returned Mrs. Micawber, "there you are wrong. You are going out, Micawber, to this distant clime to strengthen, not to weaken, the connection between yourself and Albion." "The connection in question, my love," rejoined Mr. Micawber, "has not laid me, I repeat, under that load of personal obligation that I am at all sensitive as to the formation of another connection." "Micawber," returned Mrs. Micawber.
"There I again say you're wrong. You don't know your power, Micawber. It is that which will strengthen, even in this step you are about to take, the connection between yourself and Albion."
Mr. Micawber sat in his elbow chair with his eyebrows raised, half receiving and half repudiating Mrs. Micawber's views as they were stated, but very sensible of their foresight.
"My dear Mr. Copperfield,"
said Mrs. Micawber,
"I wish Mr. Micawber to feel his position. It appears to me highly important that Mr. Micawber should, from the hour of his embarkation, feel his position. Your old knowledge of me, my dear Mr. Copperfield, will have told you that I have not the sanguine disposition of Mr. Micawber. My disposition is, if I may say so, eminently practical. I know that this is a long voyage. I know that it will involve many privations and inconveniences. I cannot shut my eyes to those facts. But I also know what Mr. Micawber is. I know the latent power of Mr. Micawber, and therefore I consider it vitally important that Mr. Micawber should feel his position."
"My love," he observed, "perhaps you will allow me to remark that it is barely possible that I do feel my position at the present moment."
"I think not, Micawber,"
she rejoined, "not fully.
My dear Mr. Copperfield, Mr. Micawber's is not a common case. Mr. Micawber is going to a distant country expressly in order that he may be fully understood and appreciated for the first time. I wish Mr. Micawber to take his stand upon that vessel's prow and firmly say, 'This country I am come to conquer. Have you honours? Have you riches? Have you posts of profitable pecuniary emolument? Let them be brought forward. They are mine.'"
Mr. Micawber, glancing at us all, seemed to think there was a good deal in this idea.
"I wish Mr. Micawber, if I make myself understood," said Mrs. Micawber, in her argumentative tone, "to be the Caesar of his own fortunes. That, my dear Mr. Copperfield, appears to me to be his true position. From the first moment of this voyage, I wish Mr. Micawber to stand upon that vessel's prow and say, 'Enough of delay, enough of disappointment, enough of limited means. That was in the old country, this is the new. Produce your reparation. Bring it forward.'"
Mr. Micawber folded his arms in a resolute manner, as if he were then stationed on the figurehead.
"And doing that," said Mrs. Micawber, "feeling his position, am I not right in saying that Mr. Micawber will strengthen and not weaken his connection with Britain? An important public character arising in that hemisphere, shall I be told that its influence will not be felt at home? Can I be so weak as to imagine that Mr. Micawber, wielding the rod of talent and of power in Australia, will be nothing in England? I am but a woman, but I should be unworthy of myself and of my papa if I were guilty of such absurd weakness.'"
Mrs. Micawber's conviction that her arguments were unanswerable gave a moral elevation to her tone which I think I'd never heard in it before.
"And therefore it is," said Mrs. Micawber, "that I the more wish that, at a future period, we may live again on the parent soil. Mr. Micawber may be, I cannot disguise from myself that the probability is, Mr. Micawber will be a page of history. And he ought then to be represented in the country which gave him birth and did not give him employment."
"My love," observed Mr. Micawber, "it is impossible for me not to be touched by your affection. I am always willing to defer to your good sense. What will be, will be. Heaven forbid that I should grudge my native country any portion of the wealth that may be accumulated by our descendants."
"That's well," said my aunt, nodding towards Mr. Peggotty, "and I drink my love to you all, and every blessing and success attend you." Mr. Peggotty put down the two children he'd been nursing, one on each knee, to join Mr. and Mrs. Micawber in drinking to all of us in return. And when he and the Micawbers cordially shook hands as comrades and his brown face brightened with a smile, I felt that he would make his way, establish a good name, and be beloved go where he would. Even the children were instructed each to dip a wooden spoon into Mr. Micawber's pot and pledge us in its contents. When this was done, my aunt and Agnes rose and parted from the emigrants. It was a sorrowful farewell. They were all crying. The children hung about Agnes to the last. And we left poor Mrs. Micawber in a very distressed condition, sobbing and weeping by a dim candle that must have made the room look from the river like a miserable lighthouse. I went down again next morning to see that they were away. They had departed in a boat as early as 5 o'clock. It was a wonderful instance to me of the gap such partings make, that, although my association of them with the tumble-down public house and the wooden stairs dated only from last night, both seemed dreary and deserted now that they were gone. In the afternoon of the next day, my old nurse and I went down to Gravesend. We found the ship in the river surrounded by a crowd of boats, a favourable wind blowing, a signal for sailing at her masthead. I hired a boat directly, and we put off to her, and getting through the little vortex of confusion of which she was the centre, went on board. Mr. Peggotty was waiting for us on deck. He told me that Mr. Micawber had just now been arrested again, and for the last time, at the suit of Heap, and that in compliance with the request I had made to him, he had paid the money, which I repaid him. He then took us down between decks, and there, any lingering fears I had of his having heard any rumours of what had happened were dispelled by Mr. Micawber's coming out of the gloom, taking his arm with an air of friendship and protection, and telling me that they had scarcely been asunder for a moment since the night before last. It was such a strange scene to me, and so confined and dark, that at first I could make out hardly anything. But by degrees it cleared as my eyes became more accustomed to the gloom, and I seemed to stand in a picture by Ostade. Among the great beams, bulks, and ring-bolts of the ship, and the emigrant berths, and chests, and bundles, and barrels, and heaps of miscellaneous baggage, lighted up here and there by dangling lanterns, and elsewhere by the yellow daylight straying down a windsill or a hatchway, were crowded groups of people making new friendships, taking leave of one another, talking, laughing, crying, eating and drinking. Some already settled down into the possession of their few feet of space, with their little households arranged, and tiny children established on stools or in dwarf elbow chairs. Others, despairing of a resting place and wandering disconsolately. From babies who had but a week or two of life behind them, to crooked old men and women who seemed to have but a week or two of life before them, and from ploughmen bodily carrying out soil of England on their boots, to smiths taking away samples of its soot and smoke upon their skins, every age and occupation appeared to be crammed into the narrow compass of the tween decks. As my eye glanced round this place, I thought I saw, sitting by an open port with one of the Micawber children near her, a figure like Emily's. It first attracted my attention by another figure parting from it with a kiss, and as it glided calmly away through the disorder, reminding me of Agnes. But in the rapid motion and confusion, and in the unsettlement of my own thoughts, I lost it again, and only knew that the time was come when all visitors were being warned to leave the ship, that my nurse was crying on a chest beside me, and that Mrs. Gummidge, assisted by some younger, stooping woman in black, was busily arranging Mr. Peggotty's goods. "Is there any last word, Master Davy?" said he. "Is there any one forgotten thing afore we parts?" "One thing," said I. "Martha." He touched the younger woman I've mentioned on the shoulder, and Martha stood before me. "Heaven bless you, you good man!" cried I. "You take her with you." She answered for him with a burst of tears. I could speak no more at that time, but I wrung his hand, and if ever I have loved and honoured any man, I loved and honoured that man in my soul. The ship was clearing fast of strangers, the greatest trial that I had remained. I told him what the noble spirit that was gone had given me in charge to say at parting. It moved him deeply. But when he charged me in return with many messages of affection and regret for those deaf ears, he moved me more. The time was come. I embraced him, took my weeping nurse upon my arm, and hurried away. On deck I took leave of poor Mrs. Micawber. She was looking distractedly about for her family even then, and her last words to me were that she never would desert Mr. Micawber. We went over the side into our boat, and lay at a little distance to see the ship wafted on her course. It was then calm, radiant sunset. She lay between us and the red light, and every taper line and spar was visible against the glow, a sight at once so beautiful, so mournful, and so hopeful, as the glorious ship lying still on the flushed water, with all the life on board her, crowded at the bulwarks, and there, clustering for a moment, bareheaded and silent, I never saw. Silent only for a moment, as the sails rose to the wind, and the ship began to move, there broke from all the boats three resounding cheers, which those on board took up and echoed back, and which were echoed and re-echoed. My heart burst out when I heard the sound and beheld the waving of the hats and handkerchiefs. And then I saw her. Then I saw her at her uncle's side and trembling on his shoulder. He pointed to us with an eager hand, and she saw us and waved her last goodbye to me. I, Emily, beautiful and drooping, cling to him with the utmost trust of thy bruised heart, for he has clung to thee with all the might of his great love. Surrounded by the rosy light, and standing high upon the deck apart together, she clinging to him, and he holding her, they solemnly passed away. The night had fallen on the Kentish hills when we were rowed ashore, and fallen darkly upon me.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 25 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 26. Cassette 26.
Chapter 58. Absence. It was a long and gloomy night that gathered on me, haunted by the ghosts of many hopes, of many dear remembrances, many errors, many unavailing sorrows and regrets. I went away from England, not knowing even then how great the shock was that I had to bear. I left all who were dear to me and went away, and believed that I had borne it, and it was past. As a man upon a field of battle will receive a mortal hurt and scarcely know that he struck, so I, when I was left alone with my undisciplined heart, had no conception of the wound with which it had to strive. The knowledge came upon me not quickly, but little by little and grain by grain. The desolate feeling with which I went abroad deepened and widened hourly. At first it was a heavy sense of loss and sorrow, wherein I could distinguish little else. By imperceptible degrees it became a hopeless consciousness of all that I'd lost. Love, friendship, interest. Of all that had been shattered, my first trust, my first affection, the whole airy castle of my life, of all that remained, a ruined blank and waste lying wide around me, unbroken to the dark horizon. If my grief was selfish, I didn't know it to be so. I mourned for my child wife, taken from her blooming world so young. I mourned for him who might have won the love and admiration of thousands, as he had won mine long ago. I mourned for the broken heart that had found rest in the stormy sea, and for the wandering remnants of the simple home where I had heard the night wind blowing when I was a child. From the accumulated sadness into which I fell, I had at length no hope of ever issuing again. I roamed from place to place, carrying my burden with me everywhere. I felt its whole weight now, and I drooped beneath it, and I said in my heart that it could never be lightened. When this despondency was at its worst, I believed that I should die. Sometimes I thought that I would like to die at home, and actually turn back on my road that I might get there soon. At other times I passed on farther away from city to city, seeking I know not what, and trying to leave I know not what behind. It's not in my power to retrace one by one all the weary phases of distress of mind through which I passed. There are some dreams that can only be imperfectly and vaguely described, and when I oblige myself to look back on this time of my life, I seem to be recalling such a dream. I see myself passing on among the novelties of foreign towns, palaces, cathedrals, temples, pictures, castles, tombs, fantastic streets, the old abiding places of history and fancy, as a dreamer might, bearing my painful load through all, and hardly conscious of the objects as they fade before me. Listlessness to everything but brooding sorrow was the night that fell on my undisciplined heart. Let me look up from it, as at last I did, thank heaven, and from its long, sad, wretched dream to dawn. For many months I travelled with this ever-darkening cloud upon my mind. Some blind reasons that I had for not returning home, reasons then struggling within me vainly for more distinct expression, kept me on my pilgrimage. Sometimes I'd proceeded restlessly from place to place, stopping nowhere. Sometimes I'd lingered long in one spot. I'd had no purpose, no sustaining soul within me anywhere. I was in Switzerland. I'd come out of Italy over one of the great passes of the Alps, and had since wandered with a guide among the byways of the mountains. If those awful solitudes had spoken to my heart, I didn't know it. I had found sublimity and wonder in the dread heights and precipices, in the roaring torrents and the wastes of ice and snow, but as yet they taught me nothing else. I came one evening before sunset down into a valley where I was to rest. In the course of my descent to it by the winding track along the mountainside from which I saw it shining far below, I think some long, unwonted sense of beauty and tranquillity, some softening influence awakened by its peace, moved faintly in my breast. I remember pausing once with a kind of sorrow that wasn't all oppressive, not quite despairing. I remember almost hoping that some better change was possible within me. I came into the valley as the evening sun was shining on the remote heights of snow that closed it in like eternal clouds. The bases of the mountains forming the gorge in which the little village lay were richly green, and high above this gentler vegetation grew forests of dark fir, cleaving the wintry snowdrift wedge-like and stemming the avalanche. Above these were range upon range of craggy steeps, grey rock, bright ice, and smooth, verdure specks of pasture, all gradually blending with the crowning snow. Dotted here and there on the mountainside, each tiny dot a home, were lonely wooden cottages, so dwarfed by the towering heights that they appeared too small for toys. So did even the clustered village in the valley, with its wooden bridge across the stream, where the stream tumbled over broken rocks and roared away among the trees. In the quiet air there was a sound of distant singing, shepherd voices, but as one bright evening cloud floated midway along the mountainside, I could almost have believed it came from there. It was not earthly music. All at once, in this serenity, great nature spoke to me and soothed me to lay down my weary head upon the grass and weep as I had not wept yet since Dora died. I had found a packet of letters awaiting me but a few minutes before, and had strolled out of the village to read them while my supper was making ready. Other packets had missed me, and I had received none for a long time. Beyond a line or two to say that I was well and had arrived at such a place, I had not had fortitude or constancy to write a letter since I left home. The packet was in my hand. I opened it and read the writing of Agnes. She was happy and useful, was prospering as she had hoped. That was all she told me of herself. The rest referred to me. She gave me no advice. She urged no duty on me. She only told me in her own fervent manner what her trust in me was. She knew, she said, how such a nature as mine would turn affliction to good. She knew how trial and emotion would exalt and strengthen it. She was sure that in my every purpose I should gain a firmer and a higher tendency through the grief I'd undergone. She, who so gloried in my fame and so looked forward to its augmentation, well knew that I would labour on. She knew that in me sorrow could not be weakness, but must be strength, as the endurance of my childish days had done its part to make me what I was. So greater calamities would nerve me on to be yet better than I was, and so, as they had taught me, would I teach others. She commended me to God, who had taken my innocent darling to his rest, and in her sisterly affection cherished me always, and was always at my side, go where I would, proud of what I had done, but infinitely prouder yet of what I was reserved to do. I put the letter in my breast and thought, what had I been an hour ago? When I heard the voices die away, and saw the quiet evening cloud grow dim, and all the colours in the valley fade, and the golden snow upon the mountain tops become a remote part of the pale night sky, yet felt that the night was passing from my mind, and all its shadows clearing, there was no name for the love I bore her, dearer to me henceforward than ever until then. I read her letter many times. I wrote to her before I slept. I told her that I had been in sore need of her help, that without her I was not, and I never had been, what she thought me, but that she inspired me to be that, and I would try. I did try. In 3 months more, a year would have passed since the beginning of my sorrow. I determined to make no resolutions until the expiration of those 3 months, but to try. I lived in that valley and its neighbourhood all the time. The 3 months gone, I resolved to remain away from home for some time longer, to settle myself for the present in Switzerland, which was growing dear to me in the remembrance of that evening, to resume my pen, to work. I resorted humbly whither Agnes had commended me. I sought out nature, never sought in vain, and I admitted to my breast the human interest I had lately shrunk from. It was not long before I had almost as many friends in the valley as in Yarmouth. And when I left it, before the winter set in for Geneva, and came back in the spring, their cordial greetings had a homely sound to me, although they were not conveyed in English words. I worked early and late, patiently and hard. I wrote a story, with a purpose growing not remotely out of my experience, and sent it to Traddles, and he arranged for its publication very advantageously for me, and the tidings of my growing reputation began to reach me from travellers whom I encountered by chance. After some rest and change, I fell to work in my old ardent way on a new fancy, which took strong possession of me. As I advanced in the execution of this task, I felt it more and more, and roused my utmost energies to do it well. This was my third work of fiction. It was not half written when, in an interval of rest, I thought of returning home. For a long time, though studying and working patiently, I had accustomed myself to robust exercise. My health, severely impaired when I left England, was quite restored. I had seen much, I had been in many countries, and I hope I had improved my store of knowledge. I have now recalled all that I think it needful to recall here of this term of absence, with one reservation. I have made it thus far with no purpose of suppressing any of my thoughts, for, as I have elsewhere said, this narrative is my written memory. I have desired to keep the most secret current of my mind apart and to the last. I enter on it now. I cannot so completely penetrate the mystery of my own heart as to know when I began to think that I might have set its earliest and brightest hopes on Agnes. I cannot say at what stage of my grief it first became associated with the reflection that, in my wayward boyhood, I had thrown away the treasure of her love. I believe I may have heard some whisper of that distant thought in the old unhappy loss or want of something never to be realized, of which I had been sensible. But the thought came into my mind as a new reproach and new regret when I was left so sad and lonely in the world. If at that time I had been much with her, I should, in the weakness of my desolation, have betrayed this. It was what I remotely dreaded when I was first impelled to stay away from England. I could not have borne to lose the smallest portion of her sisterly affection. Yet in that betrayal, I should have set a constraint between us hitherto unknown. I could not forget that the feeling with which she now regarded me had grown up in my own free choice and course. That if she had ever loved me with another love, and I sometimes thought the time was when she might have done so, I had cast it away. It was nothing now that I had accustomed myself to think of her when we were both mere children as one who was far removed from my wild fancies. I had bestowed my passionate tenderness upon another object, and what I might have done I had not done, and what Agnes was to me I and her own noble heart had made her. In the beginning of the change that gradually worked in me, when I tried to get a better understanding of myself and be a better man, I did glance through some indefinite probation to a period when I might possibly hope to cancel the mistaken past and to be so blessed as to marry her. But as time wore on, this shadowy prospect faded and departed from me. If she had ever loved me then, I should hold her the more sacred, remembering the confidences I had reposed in her, her knowledge of my errant heart, the sacrifice she must have made to be my friend and sister, and the victory she'd won. If she had never loved me, could I believe that she would love me now? I had always felt my weakness in comparison with her constancy and fortitude, and now I felt it more and more. Whatever I might have been to her or she to me, if I had been worthy of her long ago, I was not now and she was not. The time was past. I had let it go by and had deservedly lost her. That I suffered much in these contentions, that they filled me with unhappiness and remorse, and yet that I had a sustaining sense that it was required of me in right and honour to keep away from myself with shame the thought of turning to the dear girl in the withering of my hopes, from whom I had frivolously turned when they were bright and fresh, which consideration was at the root of every thought I had concerning her, is all equally true. I made no effort to conceal from myself now that I loved her, that I was devoted to her, but I brought the assurance home to myself that it was now too late, and that our long-subsisting relation must be undisturbed. I had thought much and often of my Dora's shadowing out to me what might have happened in those years that were destined not to try us. I had considered how the things that never happen are often as much realities to us in their effects as those that are accomplished. The very years she spoke of were realities now for my correction, and would have been one day, a little later perhaps, though we'd parted in our earliest folly. I endeavoured to convert what might have been between myself and Agnes into a means of making me more self-denying, more resolved, more conscious of myself and my defects and errors. Thus, through the reflection that it might have been, I arrived at the conviction that it could never be. These, with their perplexities and inconsistencies, were the shifting quicksands of my mind from the time of my departure to the time of my return home, 3 years afterwards. 3 years had elapsed since the sailing of the emigrant ship, when, at that same hour of sunset, and in the same place, I stood on the deck of the packet vessel that brought me home, looking in the rosy water where I had seen the image of that ship reflected. 3 years. Long in the aggregate, though short as they went by. And home was very dear to me, and Agnes too. But she wasn't mine. She was never to be mine. She might have been, but that was past. Chapter 59. Return. I landed in London on a wintry autumn evening. It was dark and raining, and I saw more fog and mud in a minute than I'd seen in a year. I walked from the Custom House to the Monument before I found a coach, and although the very house fronts looking on the swollen gutters were like old friends to me, I could not but admit that they were very dingy friends. I've often remarked, I suppose everybody has, that one's going away from a familiar place would seem to be the signal for change in it. As I looked out of the coach window and observed that an old house on Fish Street Hill, which had stood untouched by painter, carpenter, or bricklayer for a century, had been pulled down in my absence, and that a neighbouring street, if time-honoured in salubrity and inconvenience, was being drained and widened, I half expected to find St. Paul's Cathedral looking older. For some changes in the fortunes of my friends, I was prepared. My aunt had long been re-established at Dover, and Traddles had begun to get into some little practice at the bar in the very first term after my departure. He had chambers in Gray's Inn now, and had told me in his last letters that he was not without hopes of being soon united to the dearest girl in the world. They expected me home before Christmas, but had no idea of my returning so soon. I had purposely misled them, that I might have the pleasure of taking them by surprise. And yet I was perverse enough to feel a chill and disappointment in receiving no welcome, and rattling alone and silent through the misty streets. The well-known shops, however, with their cheerful lights, did something for me, and when I alighted at the door of the Gray's Inn Coffee House, I had recovered my spirits. It recalled, at first, that so different time when I'd put up at the Golden Cross, and reminded me of the changes that had come to pass since then, but that was natural. "Do you know where Mr. Traddles lives in the inn?" I asked the waiter, as I warmed myself by the coffee-room fire. "Home and Court, sir, number 2. "Mr. Traddles has a rising reputation among the lawyers, I believe," said I. "Well, sir," returned the waiter, "probably he has, sir, but I'm not aware of it myself." This waiter, who was middle-aged and spare, looked for help to a waiter of more authority, a stout, potential old man with a double chin in black breeches and stockings, who came out of a place like a churchwarden's pew at the end of the coffee-room, where he kept company with a cash-box, a directory, a law list, and other books and papers. "Mr. Traddles," said the spare waiter, "number 2 in the court." The potential waiter waved him away, and turned gravely to me. "I was inquiring," said I, "whether Mr. Traddles at number 2 in the court has not a rising reputation among the lawyers."
"Never heard his name," said the waiter in a rich, husky voice. I felt quite apologetic for Traddles. "'He's a young man, sure,' said the portentous waiter, fixing his eyes severely on me. "'How long has he been in the inn?' "'Not about 3 years,' said I. The waiter, who I suppose had lived in his church warden's pew for 40 years, couldn't pursue such an insignificant subject. He asked me what I would have for dinner. I felt I was in England again, and really was quite cast down on Traddles' account. There seemed to be no hope for him. I meekly ordered a bit of fish and a steak, and stood before the fire, musing on his obscurity. As I followed the chief waiter with my eyes, I couldn't help thinking that the garden in which he had gradually blown to be the flower he was an arduous place to rise in. It had such a prescriptive, stiff-necked, long-established, solemn, elderly air. I glanced about the room, which had its sanded floor, sanded, no doubt, in exactly the same manner when the chief waiter was a boy, if he ever was a boy, which appeared improbable, and at the shining tables where I saw myself reflected in unruffled depths of old mahogany, and at the lamps, without a flaw in their trimming or cleaning, and at the comfortable green curtains with their pure brass rods snugly enclosing the boxes, and at the two large coal fires brightly burning, and at the rows of decanters, burling as if with the consciousness of pipes of expensive old port wine below, and both England and the law appeared to me to be very difficult indeed to be taken by storm. I went up to my bedroom to change my wet clothes, and the vast extent of that old wainscoted apartment, which was over the archway leading to the inn, I remember, and the sedate immensity of the four-post bedstead, and the indomitable gravity of the chests of drawers, all seemed to unite in sternly frowning on the fortunes of Traddles, or any such daring youth. I came down again to my dinner, and even the slow comfort of the meal and the orderly silence of the place, which was bare of guests, the long vacation not yet being over, were eloquent on the audacity of Traddles and his small hopes of a livelihood for 20 years to come. I'd seen nothing like this since I went away, and it quite dashed my hopes for my friend. The chief waiter had had enough of me. He came near me no more, but devoted himself to an old gentleman in long gaiters, to meet whom a pint of special port seemed to come out of the cellar of its own accord, for he gave no order. The second waiter informed me, in a whisper, that this old gentleman was a retired conveyancer living in the square and worth a mint of money, which it was expected he would leave to his laundress's daughter. Likewise, it was rumoured that he had a service of plate in a bureau, all tarnished with lying by, though more than one spoon and a fork had never yet been beheld in his chambers by mortal vision. By this time I quite gave Traddles up for lost, and settled in my own mind that there was no hope for him. Being very anxious to see the dear old fellow, nevertheless, I dispatched my dinner, in a manner not at all calculated to raise me in the opinion of the chief waiter, and hurried out by the back way. Number 2 in the court was soon reached, and an inscription on the doorpost informing me that Mr. Traddles occupied a set of chambers on the top story, I ascended the staircase. A crazy old staircase I found it to be, feebly lighted on each landing by a club-headed little oil wick dying away in a little dungeon of dirty glass. In the course of my stumbling upstairs, I fancied I heard a pleasant sound of laughter. And not the laughter of an attorney or barrister, or attorney's clerk or barrister's clerk, but of 2 or 3 merry girls. Happening, however, as I stopped to listen, to put my foot in a hole where the Honourable Society of Gray's Inn had left a plank deficient, I fell down with some noise, and when I recovered my footing all was silent. Groping my way more carefully for the rest of the journey, my heart beat high when I found the outer door, which had Mr. Traddles painted on it, open. I knocked. A considerable scuffling within ensued, but nothing else. I therefore knocked again. A small, sharp-looking lad, half footboy and half clerk,
who was very much out of breath, but who looked at me as if he defied me to prove it legally, presented himself. "Is Mr. Traddles within?" said I. "Yes, sir, but he's engaged. I want to see him." After a moment's survey of me, the sharp-looking lad decided to let me in, and opening the door wider for that purpose, admitted me first into a little closet of a hall, and next into a little sitting-room, where I came into the presence of my old friend, also out of breath, seated at a table and bending over papers. "Good God!" cried Traddles, looking up. "It's Copperfield!" and rushed into my arms, where I held him tight. "All well, my dear Traddles. All well, my dear, dear Copperfield, and nothing but good news." We cried with pleasure, both of us. "My dear fellow," said Traddles, rumpling his hair in his excitement, which was a most unnecessary operation. "My dearest Copperfield, my long-lost and most welcome friend, how glad I am to see you. How brown you are. How glad I am. Upon my life and honour, I never was so rejoiced, my beloved Copperfield, never." I was equally at a loss to express my emotions. I was quite unable to speak at first. "My dear fellow," said Traddles, "and grown so famous. My glorious Copperfield, good gracious me, when did you come? Where have you come from? What have you been doing?" Never pausing for an answer to anything he said, Traddles, who had clapped me into an easy chair by the fire, all this time impetuously stirred the fire with one hand and pulled at my neckerchief with the other, under some wild delusion that it was a greatcoat. Without putting down the poker, he now hugged me again, and I hugged him, and both laughing and both wiping our eyes, we both sat down and shook hands across the hearth. "To think," said Traddles, "that you should have been so nearly coming home as you must have been, my dear old boy, and not at the ceremony." "What ceremony, my dear Traddles?" "Good gracious me!" cried Traddles, opening his eyes in his old way. "Didn't you get my last letter?" "Certainly not, if it referred to any ceremony." "Why, my dear Copperfield," said Traddles, sticking his hair upright with both hands and then putting his hands on my knees, "I am married." "Married?" I cried joyfully. "Lord bless me, yes," said Traddles, "by the Reverend Horace, to Sophie, down in Devonshire. Why, my dear boy, she's behind the window curtain. Look here." To my amazement, the dearest girl in the world came at that same instant, laughing and blushing, from her place of concealment. And a more cheerful, amiable, honest, happy, bright-looking bride, I believe, as I couldn't help saying on the spot, the world never saw. I kissed her as an old acquaintance should, and wished them joy with all my might of heart. "Dear me," said Traddles, "what a delightful reunion this is. You are so extremely brown, my dear Copperfield. God bless my soul, how happy I am." "And so am I," said I. "And I'm sure I am," said the blushing and laughing Sophie. "We're all as happy as possible," said Traddles. "Even the girls are happy. Dear me, I declare I forgot them." "Forgot?" said I. "The girls!" said Traddles. "Sophie's sisters. They're staying with us. They've come to have a peep at London. The fact is, when... Was it you that tumbled upstairs, Copperfield?" "It was," said I, laughing. "Well, then, when you tumbled upstairs," said Traddles, "I was romping with the girls. In point of fact, we were playing at Puss in the Corner. But as that wouldn't do in Westminster Hall, and as it wouldn't look quite professional if they were seen by a client, they decamped. And they are now listening, I have no doubt," said Traddles, glancing at the door of another room. "I am sorry," said I, laughing afresh, "to have occasioned such a dispersion." "Upon my word," rejoined Traddles, greatly delighted, "if you'd seen them running away and running back again after you'd knocked to pick up the combs they'd dropped out of their hair and going on in the maddest manner, you wouldn't have said so. My love, will you fetch the girls?" Sophie tripped away, and we heard her received in the adjoining room with a peal of laughter. "Really musical, isn't it, my dear Copperfield?" said Traddles. "It's very agreeable to hear. It quite lights up these old rooms. To an unfortunate bachelor of a fellow who's lived alone all his life, you know, it's positively delicious. It's charming. Poor things! They've had a great loss in Sophie. Who, I do assure you, Copperfield, is and ever was the dearest girl. And it gratifies me beyond expression to find them in such good spirits. The society of girls is a very delightful thing, Copperfield.